So we started looking at this passage last week, nearly got to the end of the book of Daniel. We looked in our summer camp in the summer holidays at some of the very well-known stories of Daniel. And then on Sunday morning since then, we've moved on to the less well-known bits of Daniel like this. And we were looking last week at the beginning bit of this chapter and the elderly prophet, Daniel, in his 80s or 90s, he's given this message. It begins in chapter 10, there's quite a lengthy introduction to it, and then more in chapter 11, and it seems to keep going then into chapter 12, and then there's a sort of conclusion then, which we'll get to next time. And he's given this true message, and yet he's told the time is going to be long for it. And the message is quite long, we might think as well. And at first glance, it does take us through some quite unfamiliar territory, some difficult things perhaps that make us scratch our heads a little bit. In the first 20 or so verses, it outlines what's going to happen from the time of Daniel and the next few hundred years, about 350 years or so. And it looks at the kings of Persia and Greece there in the first couple of verses. And then on to the battles between the kings of the north, they were known as the Ptolemies, and the kings of the south, who were the Seleucids. They were branches of the Greek Empire when it broke apart. And that takes us all the way up to about the year 175 BC, as we look basically a little bit of that last time, about these two big empires, one down here in Egypt and one over here in the old region of Babylon, and the wars that happened. And that's mostly what's going on in verses 1 to 20. There's just these battles that keep happening. And we said it's a remarkable chapter, although it's a bit strange. It's a remarkable chapter because of its historical accuracy. Here Daniel is told beforehand what's going to happen through 100, 200, 300 odd years. And Daniel is told exactly what's going to happen. And if you want to, you can work through each verse and you can look up history books. You can visit museums and you can find that every single one of these verses came true. And it's quite remarkable how Daniel was told all of this beforehand. Then we come to verse 21 and the gear changes a little bit. Rather than galloping through 300 years of history, the next half a chapter is all about 7 years of history. One person in particular, and his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the guy who's prophesied about. Bit of an odd name. But this was the chap who was prophesied about. We have dealt with him before, because he's prophesied about in one of the visions in chapter 8. So you might remember his name, or how unpronounceable it might seem to be. And God warns them in particular about this person. After all the comings and goings, all the battles that would take place, and lots of those would be marching through the land of Israel, one person will come up in particular, verse 21. He's a vile person. He's not royalty, and yet he seizes that position, and he does it by deceit and cunning all the time. And he's this man, Antiochus Epiphanes. And these things begin to come true in about the year 175 BC. Again, you can find lots of historical detail all about him. And God here tells Daniel what's going to happen. And we're told in these verses about his huge, rapid rise to power. He comes in peaceably. He seizes the kingdom by intrigue, verse 21. And then with the force of a flood, he sweeps everyone away from before him. He launches one battle after another, invading all these different places, even the richest places. Verse 24, he stirs up and battles against the king of the south. He's the king of the north, this man. And he has all these battles, and mostly all of them seem to be successful right to the very end. And he's this unstoppable force. He has all these victorious battles. He gains great riches and great plunder and spoil and so on are mentioned in some of these verses that we have. The whole way through, he's this man of deceit and intrigue. There's verse 27, when both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil and they shall speak lies at the same table. The NIV translated, the two kings will sit at a table and lie to each other's faces. It's quite striking somehow. It's sarcasm, the way it sort of drips almost with irony of this man and others and his rival, and they just sit there and lie to each other. Not a word of truth comes out of his mouth. And it continues. We're told in verse 29 he goes back towards the south, but it won't be like the last time. And ships from Cyprus shall come out against him, and he shall be grieved and return. And so it happened. These details again were given beforehand. His expansion plans in generating, creating his own empire came to an end by ships coming from Cyprus. That was the Romans and one of their Roman colonies who put a stop to it. They didn't want him invading Egypt, so they drew a line and made him retreat. And that sort of began to be the end of his demise in many ways. Again, it's one of these prophecies of astonishing detail. All of these different campaigns and battles, you can find historical dates for if you want, and the locations they all happened. Everything God said to Daniel, 350 years in advance, it all came true exactly as God said. Of greater importance in many sense for the people of Israel. Daniel was writing this. It becomes a prophecy. Remember, some of the exiles have gone back to the promised land now from Babylon. And in the end, the book of Daniel would be taken by them. It would become part of God's word. It would be read by people through those next 50, 100, 200, 300 years and onwards. And so God gives them this message, and it might seem a bit strange and not particularly relevant to us, but it was desperately relevant for them. Hopefully we can get that. For them, they were going to live through this. And this chap in particular, Antiochus Epiphanes, he was not just an army leader who kept travelling through their land on his way to different conquests and different battles. The impact he had was more than any other king in this period of time. His hatred for God and his people would have such a massive impact on their lives for years and years. And we see a bit of that in this chapter, don't we? And we had more of it in chapter 8. We're told in the end of verse 28, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, and he shall do damage and then return to his own land. Same again, end of verse 30, he shall return in rage against the holy covenant. This is after he's defeated by the Romans. Why did he take it out on God's people and do damage against them? Then we're told he will return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. So that's people who've abandoned God's people. They're going to join forces with this guy. And verse 31, forces mustered by him, they'll defile the sanctuary fortress, they'll take away the daily sacrifice, place there the abomination of desolation. They shall do wickedly against the covenant, and he shall corrupt them with flattery, and so on. And for many days, verse 33, they'll fall by the sword and flame. And so he joined with others who abandoned the covenant. He becomes the arch enemy of the Old Testament people of God. He would come, he would defile the sanctuary, that's the temple. He would break all of God's laws, do things that churn their stomachs, the people of Israel, when they saw what he was doing. He would stop the sacrifice. He would raise an abomination, and God's people would be martyred. And all these things happened. This is known as the time of the Maccabees. And again, it's all written down in various history books and things like that. The great persecutions that the people of Israel underwent in this period of time in between the Old and New Testaments. And it was horrific for them. For God's people, laws were brought against them, banning every aspect of the Old Testament religion. No one was allowed to bring a sacrifice to God. No one was allowed to keep the Sabbath. If you were noticed not working on the Sabbath, you could be killed. When parents raised their children, if they wanted to circumcise their son according to the law, if it was discovered, they'd kill the parents and the son. This went on for years. About 10 years, this kind of thing was happening in the land of Israel. It was diabolical. And here God tells them in advance, so that when it happens, as horrifying as it would be, they could keep coming back to prophecies like this, and Daniel would be the one who had the clearest prophecies of it. And they could keep coming back to go, no, God said this was all going to happen. And hopefully they could see some things in this chapter too. One thing in particular, one theme that gets repeated through it, is not just the horrors of this enemy, this despicable persecutor of God's people, but one thing that keeps coming up through it. Let me read a few snippets of some of the verses. End of verse 24, we're told he will do this, that, and the other, but only for a time. Then in verse 27, about these two kings who lie to each other, but it shall not prosper, for the end shall come at the appointed time. Beginning of verse 29, at the appointed time he shall return. And again in verse 35, this will happen till the time of the end, for it is still the appointed time. There's one phrase that keeps coming back amongst all the horrors of this prophecy. The appointed time. Who's in charge here? Is it this brute, Antiochus Epiphanes? No, it's God. And God has appointed a time. He's appointed a time for this to happen. He's set limits on his conquering and on his escapades. He's under God's control. And God's people, if they had eyes to see it, could be encouraged by that. As they looked through these prophecies and they saw them coming true, there would be people who lived through it. They could be encouraged by this truth. And see, yeah, all these things are happening. But it's all according to God's appointed time. And it will come to an end when God says so too. And perhaps that would help them then persevere through adversity. And again, in this prophecy, it's not just about this evil man. But we're told in verse 32, the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. There'll be those who know God and they know his word and they stand firm and are strong, even in these desperate days. And they're going to do great exploits, whatever that might exactly mean. And those who understand will instruct others. So maybe there'll be those in these days when it happens who would pick up the Bible and say to others, look, this is what God said. And they'll try and instruct others and help them. These were Old Testament, or between the Testament, heroes of the faith. Those who would be martyred. We're told for days they'll fall by the sword and flame, captivity and plundering. And yet they shall be purified and made white until the time comes. So there's this focus in this prophecy of Daniel, on this person in particular. But as we look at it, there's a lesson for us too, isn't it? Even if Antiochus has long been dead and buried, we can still learn from passages like this, can't we? That even when we see desperately wicked things happening in our world, and have we seen that in the last weeks and months? And we might despair sometimes, and we might hear of God's people in other parts of the world, especially being horribly persecuted for following Jesus. And sometimes we might be tempted to despair and panic. But again, Daniel teaches us these things happen according to God's appointed time. Well, let's carry on with the next little half of the next little bit of the passage, where the focus seems to change. It just generally just carries on, doesn't it? In verse 36, the king shall do according to his own will. And on it goes. And yet some things that then start to be said sound a little bit strange. He shall exalt himself above every god and speak blasphemies against the God of gods. And he shall neither regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor any god. He shall exalt himself above them all. Verse 37, he has no love for anything, not for his parents and their customs, not for someone of the opposite sex or anything like that. He just loves himself and he exalts himself. And then some things he says he won't have any god, verse 36 and 37. Then in 38, he shall honour a god of fortresses. So whether that's a god exactly, or whether he just loves the force of war and so on, it'll be hard to work it all out. And then verse 40, he'll come like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen and ships. He shall overwhelm these countries and pass through, apart from the countries of Edom, Moab and Ammon. And then as we go through these verses, by this point, it starts to become a little more clear that it's not very clear. That is that he must be talking a bit more symbolically by this point. Because even in the time of Daniel, there was no Edom, Moab and Ammon anymore. They'd long been conquered by the Babylonians. They never really returned in any way, shape or form. And they don't exist anymore in that way now. And then when you start to think about it, this seems less likely to be about this chap, Antigonus Epiphanes. He did have plenty of gods. That was the abomination that he raised in the temple. His favourite god was Zeus. And he built an altar to Zeus in God's temple. That was the abomination of desolation that they're referring to in the first instance here. And so it doesn't quite fit with him. He did have his chariots and horsemen. He never had any ships either. He never went to sea. And so it begins to be a little less about him. It's a little bit like if you're using a manual focus nowadays on your smartphones and things like that. It does it all the time. It does it automatically, so we don't notice it. But if you're manually focusing on something, other things are blurry. So I could have my camera here this morning, and I could focus it on Elliot and Elijah in the front room, but the rest of you in the front row, but the rest of you would be blurry. And then if I twisted it to change the focus, they'd go blurry, and I'd get others behind them into focus. It's a little bit like that here with Daniel. He was focusing on Antigonus Epiphanes, and then he seems to twist the lens slightly, and he goes out of focus, and Daniel starts looking beyond him. Further into the future for Daniel as well. And so these things seem to be getting a little bit more symbolic. About someone. Someone who's going to worship himself. And who's filled with hatred and no love for anyone or anything. Someone who only loves war. And has a desire to annihilate. All these sort of pictorial things that are mentioned. He's one who's a bit like Antigonus Epiphanes. He's going to persecute God's people. And the only ones who will escape are God's enemies. Edom, Moab, the Ammonites. They were the traditional enemies in the old bit of the Old Testament of the people of God. And then in chapter 12, it brings us on and says there'll be a time of trouble such as there never was even up to this time. There's going to come the worst trouble ever. And now as Daniel begins to think about these things, and he's given this message, a message that is true, but the time is long. And the time is really long. And Daniel looks at this chap who's going to come, who's going to bring persecution. And then in this vision, in this prophecy, Daniel seems to sort of focus further and further into the future. And Antigonus goes out of focus, as it were, and there's some things that aren't really true about him up until that point, verse 35. You can check all that in the history books. From verse 36, no, it doesn't really work anymore. It seems to change a bit. And I think what Daniel's beginning to do then is actually sort of fast forward then to the end of the world. And to someone who's like him, but even worse. In the New Testament, this person will be called the Antichrist. And John, in his letter, writes in a similar way. He writes to people and says, I'm going to warn you that the Antichrist is coming. And then he sort of pauses and says, but of course, Antichrists have already come. There have been lots of them. Lots of people who've stood up and fought against God and persecuted his people. And John, in his letter, right towards the end of the New Testament, says lots of them have come, like Antigonus, and others since, Herod, and others who persecuted the early church. There would be the conflict with some of the Caesars that was probably happening about that time when John wrote his letter. And he said, there's antichrists who have come, but I'll tell you about the antichrist who's still going to come. And so you get a bit of that blurriness, if that makes sense, between these different characters who are all kind of the same. And all in some ways pointing forward to someone who will come at the end. Someone even worse. And so these verses seem to be less about those things that happen in between the Testaments and more looking forward then to the end of the world and the return of Christ that will happen. And so this talk of this one who will come and his desire will be to destroy, and he worships war and fighting. He wants to annihilate and destroy many. Verse 44, he hates God's people and he enters the glorious land and he seeks to destroy. And he joins with anyone else who hates God too. And they follow after him. And he's the one who sort of spearheads this persecution. We're told then in chapter 12, this will be the worst time, the worst trouble that has ever been. And that seems to be something that's picked up in some similar symbolic language in the book of Revelation, doesn't it? Moving things towards their final showdown. And again, in looking through passages like this, or passages in Revelation, or some of the warnings of Jesus himself, they're quite sad and scary things, aren't they? To think through on a sunny Sunday morning. To think about these climactic events as things move towards the end of the world, and to think about this ferocious, brutal enemy. But again, just like for the people who lived after Daniel, to be told this by God, to be forewarned was forearmed. And so Jesus himself has the same warnings. He doesn't want to scare us and just make us petrified of the future. He wants to warn us. So we've got our thinking caps on. So we're thinking about what's happening. So we're interacting with the world around us thoughtfully and prayerfully and trying to understand these things according to God's word. And it is hard to understand these things as we look at some of these things, perhaps especially after some of the things we've seen even in recent months, even over the last year or two. We might wonder to ourselves, are we moving towards the end when Jesus will return and this world will come to an end? Maybe. We can see some things that sound a bit like that coming in place. In some parts of the world, there is some of the greatest persecution there's ever been in recorded history. And we have that duty, don't we, as God's people, to be praying for those in prison and to use some of those resources and things like that from the persecuted church to pray for them, to uphold them in prayer. We do seem to see wars breaking out on a bigger scale than have done for a little while, again sort of growing in their intensity. And perhaps there seem to be some in the world who do seem to love warfare and seem to have a desire just to destroy and are fueled by such hatred. And those things can alarm us, perhaps, as we see. So maybe we are moving towards an end. Are we quite there yet? I don't know. Just my personal guess would be perhaps not quite. I don't think there has emerged one character in particular who seems to spearhead that, the Antichrist. I don't think that's particularly obvious to notice at the minute, but I say that's just a guess. One thing we know for certain is that we're a day closer to the return of Christ than we were yesterday. And we are now in 2023, and there's only, 2 months to go to the end of the year or so. We are getting closer to the return of Christ. That's undoubtedly true, to the end of the world, and perhaps to these definitive climactic things that will happen at the end. So although we don't know it, and Jesus said, none of us do know the time of that. It'll come like a thief when we don't expect it. So we have to just look at these things and go, well, look, we just have to look at this and understand that there are various things we don't understand. But here, as we just bring things to a close, in many ways, that was the title, really. From Atticus Epiphanes to the Antichrist and the End of the World. I think we get that flow in Daniel's prophecy here. In Daniel chapter 10, he has this message and he collapses down on the floor. And we've spent 20 minutes on it. And hopefully you're not on the verge of collapsing. Just thinking, ah, this is just too much for my brain to handle. Daniel seemed to have that. In chapter 10, he has this message and he just falls to the ground. It was actually similar back in chapter 7 and 8 when he had some of these other prophecies. He's so alarmed by these prophecies that he's struggling. He's struggling with it. He's grieved by these things. And we get a bit of that that's going to be responded to in chapter 12. And so it's quite okay if we read a passage like this and feel a bit frazzled. And think, God, there's lots of this that's going over our heads and is a bit difficult for us to deal with. Because it seems that was the case for Daniel. And he was a great prophet of God. So it's quite okay if we feel a bit overwhelmed by some of these things. But an angel came to comfort Daniel in chapter 10. And in chapter 12, as it moves towards an end, there comes again a message to comfort him and to comfort us. So three things just to finish off with. First one we mentioned before, it's under God's control. We mentioned that before in the reference to this other chapter, particularly Epiphanes. There's all these references in around his story, his prophecy, to the appointed time. And there's more of that in these last verses too, about this king who will come. And verse 36, he will prosper until the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined must be done. Again, this idea that it's under God's control. He'll accomplish this wrath. He will, in the end, face God's wrath. And all the things that have been determined must happen. According to God, it's under God's control. The last bit of the chapter, verse 45. He shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, and he shall come to his end. And no one will help him. What an anticlimactic end. To the rise of this Antichrist who desires to annihilate and destroy and spearhead such persecution against God's people. And then he'll come to his end. That's it. Chop. It'll be over. God will say, that's it. You've done the things I prophesied would happen. You've done the things I've allowed you to do. And that's it. It's over. He'll come to his end, no one will help him. He'll just keel over in a ditch. Actually, that did happen to Antiochus Epiphanes. We said before he's dead and buried, but actually he's not, he's just dead. No one knows where he's buried. Because he was one of these great characters, huge personalities, huge enemies. And then he was just murdered by somebody who didn't like him. Tossed in a ditch somewhere. God's promises will stand. It's under God's control. And so, as we read passages like that, like this we've got here, God's the one who sets the timings. Don't panic. Even if it is appointed for us to live through the darkest days before the end. I don't know if we will. But we can trust God. We don't need to panic. We can trust him, for it will be under his control. We don't need to be afraid. We can keep coming back to his words. And know it's his appointed times. He's the one who's in control. Second thing, we're under God's protection. Chapter 12 begins with this very strange bit. At that time, Michael shall stand up. Now, we've met him before. He's an angel. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Again, we've got a little peek behind the scenes. And at that time, Michael, an angel, will stand up. One who stands guard over God's people. God's people are under his protection. There are angels standing guard over his people. We don't know much about the work of angels. We've got little glimpses of it sometimes in the New Testament too. Angels are ministering spirits sent to help God's people. We don't see it. And the world won't see it in all these climactic events, but there will be angels standing guard. Making sure nothing goes out of God's control. Making sure that these enemies don't do any more than God says. Not one hair on their heads can be hurt. More than just being kept safe by angels. We're kept safe by God, we know, don't we? We're safe in his hands. No one can snatch us out. And even at the end, we're told at the end of verse 1 of chapter 12, at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And that little phrase is one that's used in the New Testament to talk about those who've trusted in Jesus, those who've come to know Jesus the King. Everyone who is found written in the book will be delivered. We're under God's protection. Last thing, we're under God's promise. Even in these scary and horrifying things to think about, Antichrist and the end of the world, seeing God's people persecuted, seeing a rise of wars and destruction, we have a hope. We were just singing of it in our last hymn. We have a hope. And we have a hope that this isn't it. That this isn't all there is. A world we see around us. A world that sometimes seems such a mess and so devastated by sin. We believe in resurrection. We're told in verse 2, many of those who sleep in the dust. Now that's not just many because it means some. It means many because that's the word they use for lots. For a countless number, hundreds, millions of those who sleep in the dust shall awake. They'll rise. Here in Daniel, some of the clearest Old Testament teaching on resurrection. Some will rise to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. This is not the end that Daniel's talking about here, because there's a bit after it. When this world comes to an end, which it will do one day, those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall rise. Again, those things that are echoed in the New Testament. Some will rise to everlasting life. Some will rise to everlasting shame, it says. We are under God's promise. And so we were told earlier on in this chapter, those who know their God shall be strong. So do you know God? Are you going to be one of those who rises at the resurrection? Who's believed in the Lord Jesus Christ? The one who is the resurrection and the life? Have you trusted in him? Do you know God? Then you can know God's control, God's protection, God's promise. Whatever happens in your life, whatever happens in the future of this world, you can know those things. And you can be strong. Just as those people of Daniel's day who lived through such difficult things, they go down recorded in the Bible. Those who knew their God and were strong. And so might we be those who know our God and with his grace are strong, able to face whatever the future holds, knowing it's in God's control, and we are under his protection, and we are under his promise, the promise of eternal life through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Let's sing our last hymn. Soldiers of Christ, arise and put your armour on, strong in the strength which God supplies.